You're listening to On Subrogation, the litigation podcast about how to recover your damages from the people who caused them. We are your hosts. I'm Rebecca Wright.
And I'm Steve Alsop, and we are both experienced civil litigators and partners at Rathbone Group.
If you have questions or comments during our podcast, please email us at podcast@rathbonegroup.com.
Or you can visit us at our website, rathbonegroup.com.
Hey, Steve.
Yes.
Do you ever feel like you have to educate opposing counsel?
Every day.
And, you know, I think that the issue that we have to educate opposing counsel on the most, or the things that seem to come up the most, have to do with releases.
Yes. So you've got your case settled already. You've gone through all the thorniness there. And then you figure you're home free because the money's coming in. And that's when you can sometimes get into the most tangled, awful mess of an argument with opposing counsel.
Yeah, because all of a sudden they want to send you that 15-page release with all the language that doesn't have anything to do with your case. Mm-hmm. And it's going to bind the client in all kinds of wacky ways.
Or it's meaningless language that was written by a prospector in the 1850s.
Exactly. By these here presents.
Oh, it serves literally no purpose.
That's exactly right. Well, releases are important, though.
Sure.
They are necessary whenever one party is paying money to another party to settle a case. Mm-hmm. You do want to have some sort of a release to make sure that the party who's receiving the payment understands that that payment will settle the claims that you are expecting for the payment to settle and that you don't end up in a subsequent lawsuit regarding those same damages.
Sure. And just for everyone's clarification, we're talking about a release in the legal sense. It's a legal instrument that terminates legal liability between the releaser and a releasee. And in our case, it's going to be between an insurance company and our defendant, or you can just say a plaintiff and a defendant.
That's right. In subrogation cases, mm-hmm. we're usually seeing these releases between two insurance companies, the tortfeasor's insurance company asking the plaintiff's insurance company to sign off on a release, mm-hmm. although you may also see releases signed by the insured, either for the release as a result of the UM payments by their own carrier,
yep.
or a release of their personal injury action if they had one that they settled.
Absolutely.
So lots of places where we see releases. And so oftentimes we are looking at these releases because our client is being asked to sign them after we are accepting a settlement amount from the opposing party. Mm-hmm. And what I find is that a lot of folks do not read releases the way that they should.
Or at all.
Right, or at all.
Sometimes they're not reading them at all. Because you can find pretty glaring errors in a release or just language that will stand out to anyone as nonsense if you just read through the release. And a lot of times I feel like, you know, a couple things get changed on a case-by-case basis on the release. They leave everything else in there. And if you're asking for small changes to a clause here or a paragraph there, you run into one of two responses. Either this is massive upheaval for them or they don't know what you're talking about and say, sure, whatever. And you'll get your release language in that way.
Exactly. A lot of it is explaining to opposing counsel or opposing carriers mm-hmm. what their release language actually says.
Yeah.
Well, let's talk about some of the things that we are looking for when we are reviewing releases and when we are considering whether or not our clients should be signing these releases.
Yes, let's do that.
So first off, you want to make sure that the release is specific to your case and that the information that is provided about your case or about your claim is correct.
First things first, the big bullet points that you want to make sure are absolutely correct are, number one, that you're releasing only damages related to the claim that you're settling. So if you're in the context of a lawsuit, you're only releasing the damages that you brought in that specific lawsuit. So you want to make sure that there's a date of the injury, and you want to make sure that you identify the case number if there is one.
We won't ask our client to release the defendant from anything that happened from the beginning of time until the end of time.
Right.
Instead, we would have our client release the defendant for damages arising out of the loss that occurred on December 12th, 2018.
Yes, and then you can further narrow it down to the location of where it happened. If it's a car accident, it's pretty easy to do. You just say the city, the state, and you may even add cross streets or you know, just the general location of where the collision happened.
And it seems unimportant or nitpicky, but it's really not, because what you will end up seeing in these releases is if you're not careful about specifying the claim, you may release more than you intend to release. So let's say that we've sued a tortfeasor on behalf of our client, and the tortfeasor's name is Jane Smith, and Jane Smith is insured by ABC Insurance Company.
Mm-hmm.
And so we settle with ABC Insurance Company, and let's call our client Client Insurance Company. If the release says Client Insurance Company agrees to release ABC Insurance Company for all claims having to do with motor vehicle accident that occurred in the state of Texas in March of 2018, well, then you're not just releasing the claims regarding the accident with Jane Smith.
If you released it down, or if you narrowed it down to one day, you're still talking about probably a lot more than one claim.
It could be. Mm-hmm. So you want to make sure that you're lining everything up. You're releasing Jane Smith and her insurance company from the damages arising out of this particular loss at this particular location on this particular day involving these particular parties, as identified in the lawsuit titled X versus Y in whatever court under whatever case number.
Right.
That way, everybody is clear on exactly what claims are being released. The other thing that's really important is that if you have different claim types and you are only settling one claim type, you want to make sure that you're specifying that.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the client has pending PIP or pending BI or medical damages, and the opposing carrier is settling the property damage. Well, you want to make sure that the release that you receive does not release all claims. Instead, it releases property damage claims, claims arising and related to the property damage only.
Mm-hmm. This goes the same way, say, if the medical claim went to arbitration and it's winding through the arbitration system and you've got the property damage in state court, you don't want to release that medical because it's going through a different system. It's not subject to the lawsuit that you just settled.
Exactly. And then the other thing to be careful of are the parties that are being released. Because if you have multiple parties involved in the case, or you have multiple parties that could be liable on the claim, you don't want to sign, or have the client sign, rather, a global release that releases everybody if you're only intending on releasing the one party. So let's say that the lawsuit against Jane Smith was for a car accident where Jane Smith and John Doe both went left of center and hit each other, and then Jane Smith's car spun out and hit our insured's car. We are settling with Jane Smith and her insurance company, but the intention is to continue to pursue John Doe and his insurance company.
Mm-hmm.
Under those circumstances, you want to make sure not only that the release specifically states that you're only releasing the claims against Jane Smith and the related entities, and not, and we see this all the time, all other persons, firms, and entities, but instead that it states Jane Smith and her insurance company and all related firms and entities, entities in privity therewith. And then I also make sure that there is a line in there that states this release does not release our insurance company's claim against John Doe or entities related to him, and that those rights and claims are specifically reserved.
And you can make that crystal clear in the release.
And you should.
And you should just use regular language from this century to do it.
And while we're talking about parties, we want to make sure that the parties involved in the release are properly identified as well. In a subrogation context, the releasee, the person who is being, the entity who's being released, we've talked about, should be the tortfeasor or, you know, the person that you're releasing and the related entities. The releasor should be the client, the insurance company in the subrogation context.
Correct.
It should not be the insured of the insurance company. We don't represent them in the subrogation context.
Right. And for that same reason, we shouldn't have them signing the release either.
Correct. We should avoid having the insured sign the release, because in most subrogation actions, the insured is not a party to the lawsuit and is not really a party to the claim. We're only talking about claims that the insurance company has paid out on behalf of the insured.
And often there's going to be a separate release worked out between the insured and his or her attorney on any damages that are not subject to the subrogation suit. So if you start putting them on the subrogation release, then there's a good chance they could release things that they have no intention to release.
That's right. Now, if you have a situation where you have one lawsuit that involves the insured's claims, their out-of-pocket damages, personal injury damages, or whatever the case may be, and the subrogation claims as well, there may be discussion of a global release. I'm not necessarily against global releases. One of the things that I like about them is that you can make sure that the release doesn't involve some of the stickier language like indemnity and confidentiality language that we are going to talk about in a little bit here with regard to the insured's release. Because I have found that insured's attorneys really don't like to read releases. I mean, and we get into all kinds of trouble based on releases that our insureds have signed that then therefore extinguish subrogation rights, bind the insurance company to things that it shouldn't, make the insured liable for things that they shouldn't. And so it is nice to be able to take a look at that release, but it can get sticky because, again, as a subrogation attorney, you don't represent the insured in most situations. So you want to make sure that you're not giving them legal advice in that way, and instead you are deferring to their attorney. Mm-hmm. But you can certainly talk to their attorney about what is contained in the release.
You can absolutely guide the process, and it's nice to be able to do that in those cases.
That's exactly right.
So and who else is not the releasee?
Well, we're not the releasor.
That's what I mean.
Yes. We are not the releasor. We the attorneys, nor is our law firm. And that's another thing that gets slapped onto these releases mm-hmm. all the time.
I see not only the law firm being held out as the releasor, but also I see a lot of releases that require my signature, which is not necessary. The only person that needs to sign that is the person releasing, which would be the client.
Yes, I do see occasionally those releases that require the attorney's signature. And typically what the context of that signature is they're trying to say, you are confirming, Mr. Attorney Man, mm-hmm. that you have reviewed the terms of this release with your client, and they cannot come back later and say, I'm just a poor person who's never seen a release before, and I had no idea what I was signing. Which is totally antithetical to contract law.
A lot of times that's actually a clause in, you know, your longer releases. You get a release that's 20 pages long, you know, paragraph 39 will be, this release is made upon advice of counsel and such and such. I don't care for it.
I don't either, but it's not something that I will strike out of a release. It's not usually something I'll try to negotiate out. It just is unnecessary language.
Yeah, and that's why they would have me sign it as the attorney, is approved as to form, and the implication would be that I've gone over every line with my client and we've talked about what everything means, and it's made intelligently.
Right. And, you know, we're looking at these releases in the context of subrogation, where we are representing an insurance company who probably signs thousands of these releases a year, whereas this same defense law firm or this same lit arm of another insurance company is sending these releases not just to subrogated carriers, mm-hmm. but also to personal injury plaintiffs.
Yeah.
And if I were in their shoes, I would probably include that language about, you know, that your attorney explained everything to you as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes more sense looking at it from that angle.
So you've gotten all of the basics taken care of in your release. You have reviewed and made sure that the particular claim is properly identified as to the parties, as to the date of the loss, as to the location of the loss. So let's get into some of the more complicated aspects of releases and some real issues that can come up. And of course, I'm talking about indemnity.
Mm.
Indemnity, that dirty word when it comes to releases. In general, we say indemnity, you don't need it in this context at all.
No.
Let's talk about what indemnity language actually is. What are parties trying to achieve by including indemnity and hold harmless language?
Well, a defendant who has been sued and is now paying some kind of money to be released from liability here, their goal in getting indemnity language in there is that if they get sued on this matter again by anyone, whether it be your client again, which should never happen considering this is what we're doing here, we're releasing them and dismissing the case, we've settled, or any third party who may have some damages related to this, or say the insured brings a new claim related to this incident, they want to be fully indemnified for anything going forward. They want the money they're paying you right now that's listed on the release to be the last money they ever pay on this. And that will include their attorney's fees and litigation costs, et cetera. Anything over and above what they're paying right now, they want that to be it. And they want you to agree that if anybody does come along, that you're going to pay from now on.
Yeah, and if you look at it from the perspective of the defendant, it makes a lot of sense.
Well, of course you would want that.
You just want to, they just want to protect themselves. I mean, yeah. let's take it out of the subrogation context and simplify it. Let's say, Steve, that you and I got into a car accident.
Of course.
Let's say that you decided it was my fault. You guys, it totally wasn't my fault. And so I agree to pay for some damages to you. And we agree on a figure. Let's yep. say that we agree that I'm going to pay you $1,000 to release all of your claims. And I am an attorney, so I know that I want you to sign a release. Mm-hmm. Even though we're not going to file a lawsuit, we've agreed that we're not going to file a lawsuit. We've agreed that you're going to take this $1,000 and you're going to walk away and we're going to be done.
Yeah.
Well, as the person giving you the $1,000, I want you to sign a release that says that you are never going to come back after me or against my insurance company or anybody else related to me for any damages resulting from this car accident.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do, then I want you to indemnify me for any attorney fees that I might have to pay to defend against such a claim. I want you to pay me back for my damages and having to defend against you bringing a claim that we agreed you weren't going to bring.
Sure.
But here's the thing. Especially in the context of a lawsuit, indemnity is not necessary, at least for the purpose of preventing further action,
mm-hmm.
because what you should be doing is agreeing to dismiss the case with prejudice.
Yes, and that goes to a broader point about releases in a general sense, is that dismissal with prejudice should, you know, and this is big quotes, should protect the defendant in every case, no matter what.
Right.
Once you dismiss that case with prejudice, you're saying I can't sue again on the facts that are in the complaint. That, for me, would be enough. But then again, I'm a plaintiff's attorney, so...
You're sitting on the wrong side of the table.
Yeah, I'm sitting on the wrong side of the table. It's not, you know, it's not enough assurance. It's enough insurance for me because I know once my file is closed, I'm on to the next one. I've got a lot of these.
Right.
So
res judicata attaches mm-hmm. with regard to the plaintiff insurance company's claims that were asserted in the lawsuit. So
yeah.
that we understand. But let's think about other things that can come up in the life of this after the release is signed.
Yeah.
What if the opposing carrier pays the money back to the subrogated carrier and the release is signed and the case is dismissed, the subrogation case is dismissed, and then the insured pops up and
yeah.
says, wait, my laptop was in the front seat of that car.
I totally forgot.
And it's worth $10,000 because it's a fancy schmancy gaming laptop because I'm going to win all the Worlds of Warcraft. And and so, of course, the insured, I'm assuming, would first go back to their insurance company, and their insurance company is probably going to say that wasn't covered
yeah.
as part of these general auto damages. And so then where is the insured going to go next? They're going to go running right to the tortfeasor and or the tortfeasor's insurance company.
Mm-hmm.
And the tortfeasor's insurance company wants to be protected against that because the money that they paid to the subrogated carrier, they want that money to prevent any further actions. And that's another reason why this indemnity language gets built in, but it's exactly why we have to be careful of it.
Mm-hmm.
Because we do not want the client to bind itself to pay for damages that are otherwise not covered under the insurance policy by virtue of this indemnity language. So if you have a release and the tort or the torts insurance carrier builds in there that the subrogated carrier is going to indemnify the tortfeasor and its insurance company for any claims by any party, including the subrogated carrier's insured, arising out of this loss, well then, if the insured brings that $10,000 laptop claim,
mm-hmm.
under the bare description in that contract, now the insurance company, the subrogated carrier, is liable for those damages, or potentially so.
Yes, and as you mentioned, the reason that the insurance company denied the claim in the first place is because it wasn't covered. Now they're paying for that claim, plus they're paying for attorney's fees, and this is without any respect to the limits of the policy at all anyway. So suppose your insured had, you know, $10,000 or $15,000 limits on property damage. Now you're getting into potentially paying twice what the limits are.
That's right.
So it's not a good situation for an insurance company client to just let the indemnity language fly in situations like that. And that's just with respect to the insured, but there are all other manner of people who could potentially bring a claim related to the incident, and you don't want to be on the hook for their claims either.
Medicaid. Right. And And it's a whole host of issues. And so what we do on the subrogation side of things is we try to prevent this indemnity language from being included in these releases at all. Mm-hmm. And so my technique with it is that when I am reaching the settlement, and usually this is happening via email, or I'm sending a confirmation email of the settlement amount and providing instructions for where to send the check and documentation and things like that. What I will do is, first of all, I will send a draft form release of my own to opposing counsel. Mm-hmm. But then I will also note that if they want to send me their release, I'm happy to review it with my client, but to note that my client will not sign a release that contains indemnity language or broad indemnity language.
I do the same thing anytime I'm asking. I give folks the payment information. That's one thing that happens in every settlement. Please make the check payable to X, send it to this address, and if you require release, please omit confidentiality, indemnity language, and you know, XYZ other language that I know I'm going to object to anyway. It helps shorten the process, let them know that this is going to be what I expect in the release. And then, of course, if they insist on indemnity language, so we can get into that later as part of a negotiated release. And we're going to talk about different ways you can negotiate that indemnity language.
Right. But if you've sent that initial communication in writing via a letter or via email, then you can go back to it when they invariably send you a release that contains a big fat indemnity provision and say, pursuant to my correspondence on this date, don't do it.
The snarky email.
But it is useful. And what you will find is that you'll get those releases and you won't get the release with a note from opposing counsel or from the opposing carrier saying, hey, I saw your note in your email, but our releases have to include this language. Instead, you just get the release because they haven't read it. Mm-hmm. So they don't know that that's there.
Yep.
And so now you have to talk to them about it. That's right. That's right. You're the one who's going to, to protect the client, not them.
And it's our client that's signing it. So if you're a plaintiff's attorney, you know, you can't just not read the release. That's unacceptable.
Well, and clients should be reading releases, too. If they're doing this outside of the context of a lawsuit, mm-hmm. then it is very important to look out for this language. So then you get into negotiating this language. So let's say that you receive the release. It has a big, broad indemnity provision saying that you're agreeing to indemnify the tortfeasor and its carrier for any other claims that may arise relating to this law. Mm-hmm. Or relating to the monies released herein. So the first thing you want to do is try to strike it and get it out entirely. But if you're not able to do that, there are some ways to limit that language so that it accomplishes what the tort wants it to accomplish, but still protects the subrogated carrier from additional liability. And some of the ways that we do that are to limit the indemnity language only to the extent that the undersigned has a subrogated claim. Mm-hmm. So in that way, you are limiting those cases with the laptop.
Yeah.
Another way to say it is only to the extent that the claim would be properly payable pursuant to the applicable policy of insurance. So again, your insured brings that laptop claim. The subrogated carrier says, it's not covered. The insured then tries to bring that action against the tortfeasor and or its carrier. They come back and say, hey, subrogated carrier, you indemnified us. And you say, no, we only indemnified you to the extent that the claims brought would be properly payable pursuant to the applicable policy. Here is why it's excluded under our policy, and then the indemnity is not going to apply. And then the other thing that we like to build in is to limit the indemnity not to exceed the amount being paid under the release agreement. So if the opposing carrier is paying $5,000 to settle this claim, you're not going to end up with the subrogated carrier being liable for an additional $20,000 as a result of an indemnity claim. They're only going to be liable up to the amount that they received as part of that transaction.
So at no point will they be paying anything additional.
That's right. There are some cases where it's almost impossible to get rid of this indemnity, or it's impossible to modify it. Mm-hmm. And specifically, government claims tend to have government form releases that are not terribly modifiable.
And I've seen it also in bigger auto manufacturers. Some of the bigger auto manufacturers, I won't name any of them, but they will have release language that they absolutely insist on, and it always includes a certain amount of indemnity and a great amount of confidentiality.
Right. And But with regard to indemnity, what I've noticed is that in the government entity indemnity agreement or releases with indemnity, and even in the large corporate releases with indemnity, the indemnity is typically fairly well crafted so that mm-hmm. it does only apply to your particular instance and to what you are releasing.
I'd go along with that, yeah.
They seem to be relatively fair. And remember, you don't have to sign the release. Your alternative, if the language is really dangerous, your alternative is to proceed for a judgment.
Yeah.
Because if you are able to get a court judgment, then there is no requirement for a release. They just have to pay you.
They have to pay you, and you're not indemnifying anyone for anything.
That is exactly right. So, Steve, you've mentioned a couple of times here as we've talked about indemnity, another issue that tends to occur in these more complex releases, and that is confidentiality.
Absolutely, and that's usually a clause in a release, is that the defendant wants an assurance that you're not going to go around discussing the terms of the release with other folks, and then you're not going to discuss the terms of the case with other people, and you're not going to go even further and just drag their name all through the mud and say this company makes hazardous products, or this company can't hire a driver who can stay on the road. You're not going to go around telling everyone and basically publishing what's happened with respect to the lawsuit.
Yes, and what's interesting is we don't see confidentiality in every release.
Right.
Like you mentioned before, they tend to be quite common when you are dealing with large corporate entities.
Yeah.
They're very concerned about what you were talking about in terms of the public perception of them.
But if it's just a random driver with his insurance company and there's been a collision with your driver and your insurance company, first of all, there should be no reason for confidentiality there because
right.
it doesn't matter. But oftentimes there isn't either. If they insist on yes. confidentiality in those cases, you have to wonder what's going on.
And again, I mentioned before that one of the first things we do is send the form release. Our form release does not include confidentiality because, like you say, in most circumstances, it's just not necessary.
Mm-hmm.
Really, like you mentioned, there are only a couple of reasons why anyone is ever concerned about confidentiality. One is public perception. And again, that's large corporate entities. This auto manufacturer doesn't want everyone to think that their cars catch fire randomly. but then the other reason that companies will often request confidentiality is that they don't want everyone to understand, or they don't want potential plaintiffs in other cases to know that they are willing to settle.
Yeah, and they don't want people building up a database of here's what they usually pay
right.
in response to a products liability case.
Exactly.
And then you've got everyone walking around like, well, if you sue, X giant big box corporation, typically they'll start out paying you 50% and then it goes up from there. They couldn't have that because then people would be making claims all the time. Some of them might not have merit. They want to do this individually and quietly. So
exactly. So for that reason, confidentiality provisions are understandable. And when they are included, we do try to strike these when we can. And we strike them for a good reason. And that is that there are times when disclosures to other parties are necessary.
They're actually contractually necessary on the basis of your being an insurance company or your client being an insurance company, rather.
That's right. In the subrogation context, for example, the client is going to have to disclose something to their insured
mm-hmm.
regarding the settlement because in most situations, they're going to be paying back all or part of the deductible.
Yeah.
So in that way, if you've got an ironclad confidentiality agreement that's trying to say that your client cannot tell anybody that a settlement was even reached, well, then they could potentially breach that merely by paying the deductible back to the insured.
Which is absurd.
It is absurd, but under the plain language of the contract, and a release is a contract,
mm-hmm.
under the plain language of it, you could find yourself in that situation. In addition, clients have to provide this kind of information to tax preparers and accountants. They're obviously going to disclose to their attorneys, so on and so forth.
They will have more than one attorney working on the same case in certain circumstances. It would be crazy for them not to be able to talk to their defense attorney about a settlement that happened on the subrogation application end, for example.
That's right. So of course, again, we start this process by when we're reaching the end of the negotiation process as far as the amount of the settlement, we'll send the correspondence that says, you know, please take note that your release should not include indemnity and confidentiality, and then the other side may send it anyway, and so then we send it back stricken, and then they may say, no, we need some confidentiality. So then what we want to do is make sure that the confidentiality provision is crafted in such a way that our client can go about its business the way that it needs to go about it.
Mm-hmm. And the way you do that is to carve out the exception for certain entities, and that would be, as you mentioned, tax preparers, accountants, attorneys, the insured, and even something else that's broad, just say other business purposes.
That's right.
On a need-to-know basis, something like that, that would just get your client out the door, able to continue to do business as they normally would, and not have to worry about, you know, I can't say anything about the fact that we received a 60% settlement on this, you know, case 6 months ago.
That's right, because neither you nor the client are really interested, I hope, in going to the nightly news to tell them about this settlement.
No.
So as long as you can carve out those exceptions in that way, then everybody should be happy. And I will say, in most circumstances, even when I've got somebody who's really pushing on the confidentiality, as long as we provide those carve outs, they usually will agree to that modification.
Yeah. You're not going to write a book.
No.
About.
A tell-all about this 60% settlement?
Exactly.
Probably not. So once you have gotten over indemnity and confidentiality, you may think that you are home free, but there are a couple of little things that can still cause you some trouble. One of those that, I don't know, this is a personal pet peeve of mine, is that people love to include this language in their releases. The releasing party or the releasor agrees to accept payment in the amount of X dollars, receipt and sufficiency of which is hereby acknowledged. Mm-hmm. Oh, it makes my blood boil every time I see it.
And why is that?
Because when you say that the receipt is acknowledged,
The
client is signing that as of the date of that release, they've received the payment. And the reason I have a problem is invariably this language comes on a release that has a cover letter that says, as soon as you return the signed release, we'll send you the check.
So you're saying that words in English mean very specific things.
They have specific meaning.
And we should continue to use the words commensurate with their definition.
Literally.
Oh, no.
Okay, we're not gonna go down that rabbit hole literally yet. But so to be clear, the sufficiency of which is reasonable language. Everyone is agreeing that this amount of money is sufficient to settle the case. That's why we are signing a release. It's the fact that we have to have the client sign off and attest, because this is an attestation, that they have received money that they haven't actually received.
Well, you're going to start out, and usually this is the first line of a release.
Yes.
Too. That's the best thing about it. The first line of the release, you're having your client agree to a thing that is, everyone knows, is not true.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
The other way they like to stick this in there is, instead of the receipt of which is acknowledged, they'll put in hand paid.
In hand paid.
Which also, everyone knows at this time, defense and plaintiff both know that the money hasn't changed hands. The in hand is still in the defendant's hand.
That's right.
So it's not been paid.
That's right. And this is another example of people not reading their own releases that they are sending out, because nobody sends the cover letter that says, once we receive the signed release, then we'll send you the check, and then sends you a release that says, agree that you've already received the check. They don't do it on purpose.
No.
But they will never admit it.
No, I've sent this language back to defense counsel, you know, hundreds of times.
Yep.
Have to. A couple of them have argued with me on it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, we're going to pay you.
Great.
Well, I get it, but you haven't yet. We
right.
can all agree on that. And how can I have my client swear that they have been paid when they haven't been paid?
And
I understand that you're a reasonable person, and you know it would cause you so much more problems to just not pay this after I signed a release than it would be worth to just not pay the thing in the first place.
But it also wouldn't be the first time that had happened.
Well, I mean, I'm sure it has. But
so,
I can't just say, I can't ignore the
right.
fact that it says we have the money when we don't have the money.
No, but I mean, what I mean is we've had situations where we return the release and then the money never gets paid.
Mm-hmm.
Is the reason we're not just being pedantic here.
Yeah.
Like, we are protecting the client's rights. And so there are...
And
there
it's
are,
kind of all about the money, really.
At the end of the day.
We didn't do all this just to have a pen pal. Like,
I have enough friends. We don't need more.
I really insist that you pay the settlement if we're, gonna
if we're
going
to... If we're going to agree that we have been paid. So there are a couple of ways to handle this kind of language. One way is to strike the in-hand paid or the receipt language and, you know, initial it and sign it, you know, have the client sign it and return it, or negotiate that language out and try to explain to the opposing carrier or the opposing attorney why you need that language stricken. Hey, it says right here that we are not signing this release until we receive the check, yet you told me in your letter that you're not sending the check till we sign the release. So if you're not going to send the check until we sign the release, then we need to strike this language. The other way, and I actually prefer this way just because, as you mentioned, it's all about the money. The other way to handle it is you review the release, you figure out everything else that might be wrong with it, you know, get it negotiated and point out in that negotiation, I'm going to have my client sign this release, but I'm not going to send it to you until I receive the payment. Mm-hmm. Because your release says that my client is not releasing you until the payment is received.
Yeah.
And so that way you ensure that that signed release is not sitting in, you know, defense counsel or in the opposing carrier's file for them to use whenever they want, even though they haven't paid the money. You get the money and then you sign the release. It's important to make sure that you send that release, that signed release, once the money is received and probably before you cash the check. But as long as you do that, then that's another great way to handle that language.
Mm-hmm. We'll still see it a lot.
We do. We see it every day, every day. And we will continue to educate every adjuster and every defense counsel in America about what the words in hand paid or receipt whereof.
I have to assume that this kind of tradition goes back years and years where you don't get the money until you get the release back.
Sure.
So I want to know how receipt of which wound up in every release first time and why it continues to be in every release going forward when everybody knows that's not how it works.
That's
who put that in
true.
There first? And why does it, how did it spread to everyone's release?
I think that it started with Buy These Here Presents.
Yeah. Let's not get started on Buy These Here Presents and the variations of that one, because I've seen that a number of different ways.
I'm sure any of you all out there listening who have dealt with releases have seen that language, and I will say that I think we've just made our peace with it, and we just sort of, everyone just ignores it. It doesn't mm-hmm. make any sense. It's not how language works anymore, but we are all just going to live with Buy These Here Presents.
I think we should start whiting it out on every release and sending it back as if we... this is nonsense. We can't sign it.
We can't. I'm striking that. The rest of the release is completely fine, but I have to strike Buy These Here Presents. Then the final thing, and this is one that comes up if you're dealing with tortfeasors or opposing carriers who are in a country other than the United States, is this seems like a little thing, but make sure that your release specifies that it's in U.S. dollars or that it's in the currency that you want it to be in. Because you know what? Exchange rates change every day, and you will end up with a world of trouble when, you know, let's say a Canadian carrier sends you the release amount in Canadian dollars, which does not equal the U.S. dollars by the time that they send it to you 30 days after you guys have negotiated the release amount. So it's important to just, you know, make sure that the release specifies that the amount stated is in U.S. dollars.
As always, you want to make sure that you all are agreeing to the same things.
That's right.
Defense can't agree to something that's totally different than plaintiff's agreeing to, then you don't have an agreement.
I mean, that's the whole point of the release mm-hmm. process. That's the whole point of all of these negotiations. It's the whole point of these documents. And, you know, we mentioned that we have a form release that we like to use. I've drafted them. I'm going to tell you, they're not 15 pages long.
No.
You can get all the protections that you need, all the protections that the tort needs, built into a release that is one, max three paragraphs long.
Mm-hmm.
These 17 paragraph releases are just not strictly necessary in the subrogation context. And again, we understand that there are other issues at play when you're dealing with individual claimants, personal injury claims and things like that. Yes, there are other protections that you may need. But in the subrogation context, when you are talking about one insurance company releasing another insurance company or one insurance company releasing a corporation, you really shouldn't need so much.
And you should be happy to accept our help when we send you our form release.
Well, hopefully this podcast makes it out to every attorney and claims adjuster in America, and everyone will start to smooth out their release processes and everything will be hunky-dory. What do you think, Steve?
I think you should let us guide you on releases, and if we all did things my way... No, we can all at least agree on what release language is required, and I think what...
And what it means.
What the language means is actually more important to me.
That's right. Well, if you have questions about anything that we've discussed with regard to releases today, if you would like to suggest a future topic or refer a file, please email us at podcast@rathbonegroup.com.
Or visit our website, www.rathbonegroup.com.
If you enjoy the podcast, we ask that you subscribe to us on iTunes or wherever you find your podcasts. And if you really like it, give us a rating. We want to thank Ralph DiSilvestro for composing and performing our intro and outro music, and invite you to join us again soon on Subrogation.